From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. Washington says it can't find Osama bin Laden, but it's communicating with him. The U.S. will attend the WTO meeting in Qatar after receiving assurances from bin Laden that it's safe. We'll talk with the reporter who broke the story. What is national security? War, more police, detentions and surveillance, or global economic justice? Anti-globalization activists reframe the debate. And should activists organize against the war? Discussion between Todd Gitlin, Katha Pollitt, and young anti-war activists. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. has used the biggest conventional bomb in its armory, the 15,000-pound Daisy Cutter, at least twice in Afghanistan in the last few days. The bombs are pushed out of the back of C-130 aircraft on pallets and detonate about 3 feet above the ground, covering a mile-wide area with a mushroom cloud of aluminum powder which burns at about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The explosion has been described as being like a nuclear weapon without the fallout. The Pentagon says it's using the bombs on Taliban caves. The blast would crush underground tunnels and structures, and people inside would be incinerated. The Washington Post is reporting the initial global outburst of solidarity with the U.S. after September 11th has frayed considerably. In opinion polls and interviews in several countries in Africa, Asia, South America, and Europe, many people who say they're horrified by the September 11th attacks added that the horror then does not justify the bombing of Afghanistan now, even if their governments continue to back the U.S. campaign. Many say it's not so simple as what Bush describes as a battle between good and evil. In Germany, polls show more than 65% of respondents now want the U.S. attacks to end. In Spain, a poll shows nearly 70% want the bombing to stop. Support for the U.S. war has also dropped dramatically in France and Britain. Meanwhile, President Bush yesterday delivered what The Guardian is calling his most belligerent speech since the wavering U.S. bombing campaign began, issuing two extraordinary messages to his allies as he tried to keep them in line. He first described what could happen if Osama bin Laden obtained nuclear weapons. Then he threatened his allies with action if they failed to provide more support to the U.S. He says, "A coalition builder must do more than just express sympathy. A coalition builder must perform." The president went on to say, "It's going to be important for nations to know they will be held accountable for inactivity. You're either with us or you're against us in the fight against terror." The London Guardian is reporting that FBI and military intelligence officials in Washington say they were prevented for political reasons from carrying out full investigations into members of the bin Laden family in the U.S. before the terrorist attacks of September 11th. FBI documents shown on BBC News last night and obtained by The Guardian show they had earlier sought to investigate two of Osama bin Laden's relatives in Washington and a Muslim organization, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, with which they were linked. But the FBI files were closed in 1996, apparently before any conclusions could be reached on either the bin Laden brothers or the organization itself. High-placed intelligence sources in Washington told The Guardian this week there were always constraints on investigating the Saudis. They said the restrictions became worse after the Bush administration took over this year. The intelligence agencies had been told to back off from investigations involving other members of the bin Laden family, the Saudi royals, and possible Saudi links to the acquisition of nuclear weapons by Pakistan. Meanwhile, the FBI has conducted what the intelligence that the FBI has concluded that the intelligence behind last week's warning that terrorists might attack West Coast bridges wasn't credible. The FBI had received uncorroborated intelligence suggesting terrorists might strike suspension bridges on the West Coast and issued a private warning to law enforcement in 8 states. The warning also went to many companies in the region through the FBI's InfraGuard network that alerts industry to threats. California Governor Gray Davis then took the information public the next day, and a top FBI official acknowledged agents still had few clues in the investigation into anthrax attacks, and that federal law enforcement officials still didn't know the number of U.S. labs that handled anthrax or other biological agents. Republican multi-billionaire media mogul Michael Bloomberg parlayed his bankroll and Mayor Rudy Giuliani's backing to narrowly defeat Democrat Mark Green last night to become New York's 108th mayor. In a 5-to-1 Democrat town, Bloomberg spent more than $50 million of his own fortune, spending more money in a city mayoral race than ever before in the country. Green faced lingering resentment among Latinos and blacks who were upset by what they considered racially divisive tactics against the Bronx Borough President Fernando Ferrer in the Democratic primary runoff. Ferrer, Bronx Democratic boss Roberto Ramirez, and the Reverend Al Sharpton refused to speak out for the consumer advocate Mark Green this past week, likely costing Green crucial votes in minority neighborhoods that are Democratic strongholds. In New Jersey, Democrat Jim McGreevy was elected governor, ending 8 years of Republican control. In Virginia, Democrat Mark Warner, a multimillionaire cell phone mogul, defeated Republican Mark Early to become governor. And Cincinnati Mayor Charlie Lukin won re-election despite harsh criticism of his response to mass protests sparked by the police killing of an unarmed black man last spring. Organizers of the annual World Economic Forum will announce today they're preparing to abandon Davos, its alpine home for the past 3 decades, in favor of New York. The decision comes after a disagreement with the Swiss government over security and who should cover the cost.
Marching on the freedom highway.
The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman, and that was Freedom Highway. Not exactly what we see outside of the firehouse here in downtown Manhattan. Just this morning, as I came in on a taxi cab, the police block checkpoint outside, we were stopped by the U.S. Army. They asked the taxi cab driver for his documents. They were fully armed. The U.S. soldiers who came over in their camouflage uniforms. And when they left, I asked the cab driver how he felt. He said, I am a Muslim, and this is what it is to be a Muslim in America today. Well, the Bush administration and Pentagon may not be able to find Osama bin Laden, but they're communicating with him through the Emir of Qatar, at least according to the German newspaper Die Tageszeitung. This week, trade ministers from around the world are traveling to the tiny Gulf Emirate of Qatar, where the WTO will begin its ministerial meeting on Friday amidst unprecedented security. After massive popular protests disrupted the last WTO meeting in Seattle, Qatar was the only country willing to host this year's gathering. The country has no freedom of speech or assembly, no political parties, unions, or elected legislature, and had pledged to tightly restrict the entry of WTO critics to prevent protests. Qatar is home, however, to the cable network Al Jazeera, the freest source of news in the Arab world. Since September 11th, U.S. officials have slammed Al Jazeera for carrying criticism of the U.S. and broadcasting tapes of Osama bin Laden. The attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon decisively changed the significance of the WTO meeting. Many countries, including the U.S., worried about the possibility of political unrest and event terrorist attacks in Qatar, while the U.S. and Britain bombed Afghanistan. But the WTO decided to go ahead with the meeting after the U.S. received assurances, apparently from Osama bin Laden, that there would be no trouble. We're joined by Andreas Zumach, who is the reporter who broke the story. He joins us from Geneva. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, tell us what you understand the line of communication is.
Well, let's start with the history before September 11th. Qatar was the only country, after the events of Seattle in December 99, the only country among the 142 WTO members which was prepared to organize this fourth WTO ministerial conference. Everybody was happy about that because, as you pointed out, Qatar would ensure that critical non-governmental representatives would not get into the country, that there would be no demonstrations. And I would warn against mixing the kind of critical demonstrations we have seen in Seattle and at other places over the past years with what we now call terrorist attacks. I think these are two different things. After September 11th, though, the U.S. security agencies, CIA, NSA, and others, provided the Bush administration with a huge amount of very detailed threat assessments concerning Qatar itself and the neighboring countries of Oman, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, so the Gulf region. There were threat assessments, for instance, that the Qatari security forces, the army, the police, were, quote, not capable to doing the job of protecting such a meeting like the WTO ministerial conference, that they were not politically reliable, that, for instance, the army is comprised to up to 90% out of citizens of Yemen and not of Qatar, that the army is infiltrated by al-Qaeda cells, that a number of al-Qaeda cells are operating in the country, and that the venue where the WTO meeting is supposed to be held, the big Sheraton hotel complex, which is shaped like a big pyramid, would be, quote, a prime target for air attacks like the ones that happened on September 11th in New York at the World Trade Center. So this was a security assessment the Bush administration got right after 11th of September from its own security agencies. And on the basis of that, the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick was very concerned, and he tried everything to find an alternative venue to Doha. There were contacts with Geneva, which is the headquarters of the WTO, but the Swiss authorities immediately rejected this idea because they are afraid of Seattle-like demonstrations. Singapore would have been prepared, even though it would have been difficult to organize it within 4 or 5 weeks. After the military strikes against Afghanistan began on October 7th, the assessment somewhat changed within the Bush administration. And in the end, those like President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld prevailed with their view that taking away the conference from Doha would be perceived not only in Qatar but all over the Arab world and the Islamic world as an insult, and this might endanger the support for the international coalition against terrorism. And the final decision for the U.S. government to go to Doha came in a telephone call on October 18th between Vice President Dick Cheney and the Emir of Qatar, Emir Khalafi Al-Thani. In this talk, the Emir told Cheney that, number one, they had the al-Qaeda sympathizers in the country full under control around the clock, and he secondly told them, and this is a new thing now, that he, the Emir, got assurances from Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda network that they would not conduct any attacks before and during the WTO conference. And the Emir had gotten this assurance by threatening to close down the Al Jazeera television station, which, as you said earlier already, is so far the only channel through which bin Laden and the al-Qaeda people could get their positions and messages out to the world. So, but the U.S., by deciding to go ahead with having the conference in Doha and to send a delegation with three members of the government, at the same time could not be sure and was not sure that they could 100% rely on those assurances. And therefore, after October 18th, there have been a number of rather secretive briefings in which all those U.S. citizens who originally had planned to go to Doha, who already had booked hotels, bought tickets, etc., have been briefed intensively and very detailed about the security assessments of the CIA and others. I'm talking about the government delegation members, I'm talking about U.S. senators, members of Congress, I'm talking about business representatives and lobby groups who plan to go to Doha, and also the non-governmental, the more critical non-governmental NGOs. At none of these meetings, as far as I'm informed, the government clearly told people not to go. But the net result is that after having been briefed about the security risks and about the very stringent security measures that are being taken, especially to protect U.S. citizens down there, 75% of all U.S. citizens who originally had planned to go to Doha will not go.
We're talking to Andreas Zumach, who is with the German newspaper Die Tageszeitung, which broke the newspaper, broke the story. USA received assurances from bin Laden for a WTO conference in Doha, the capital of Qatar. How do you know this?
Well, I got my sources are diplomatic sources, diplomatic circles of the U.S., of Qatar, of Pakistan, and sources in the WTO headquarters here in Geneva. Pakistan is of importance because prior to the telephone conversation between Vice President Cheney and Emir Al-Thani on October 18th, these same kind of assurances from bin Laden had been already channeled to the CIA, and this happened via the Pakistani security service.
And how exactly is bin Laden communicating?
Well, bin Laden is communicating through messengers with the Qatari government, as far as I was informed. I have no indications that he himself personally, I mean physically, has been in Doha in this period since September 11th, though it cannot be excluded. But I simply don't have this information. You know there are persistent informations which have been published by the French newspaper Figaro last week and the Radio International in Paris, that bin Laden actually spent 2 weeks in a special hospital in Dubai, the capital of the United Arab Emirates, in July this year, and that he was visited during these 2 weeks by a high-ranking CIA agent. For this, there are at least six witnesses. The story is being denied by the CIA. But according to these French publications, and they stick to their story, bin Laden has been in July for 2 weeks in the United Arab Emirates, which is a neighbor country to Qatar. So it might well be possible that he also has been in Qatar. But again, I don't know that, according to my information, these assurances have been passed on to the Emir through messengers of the Al-Qaeda network.
Meanwhile, a front page story today, Washington Post, that worldwide support for the war is falling. You're in Geneva. You write for a German newspaper. What is the sentiment in both places?
Well, in Geneva, there is still a, let's say, aftershock about the fact that two important bodies of the United Nations in New York, this is the Security Council and also the General Assembly, both on September 11th, again September 28th, and on October 8th after the military strikes against Afghanistan began, gave what since is being interpreted a green light for these kind of military strikes. There has never been an explicit formal mandate given for these military strikes, but the very fact that the Security Council twice and the General Assembly once took unanimous decisions, and in the case of the meeting after the military strikes began on October 7th, did not reject the arguments the American and the British ambassadors put forward. All this is being interpreted as de facto a political consensus and agreement to the strikes. Secretary General Kofi Annan was here last week, And he was asked very tough questions here, which he could not answer very well. He was, for instance, asked whether in the future, if any country feels threatened and feels the right to use Article 51 of the UN Charter, which is the collective or individual self-defense right, whether this country then could go ahead with military attacks even without getting an explicit mandate by the UN Security Council. And he only could say that, to his interpretation, these recent decisions in New York only refer to the case of Afghanistan. He then was asked whether he is, what his perception is of what the military goals and what the military strategy of the U.S. in this war in Afghanistan is. And he had to drop his pants and only could say that he is not privy to these information, that he is not being briefed about the strategic and tactical goals of this war, and that therefore he couldn't answer this question. But at the same time, the war is being perceived as being supported by the UN, and the humanitarian organizations of the United Nations system, who all are based here in Geneva, like the Refugee Organization, the World Food Program, they are very much upset about this, and for them it's probably the biggest challenge since the end of the Second World War. In my own country, Germany, as the listeners probably know, the government of Chancellor Schröder and Foreign Minister Fischer, Schröder being a Social Democrat, Fischer being a Green member, for weeks have now urged the U.S. government to ask them to make some kind of military contribution, not only to give the political support, as Germany did right away after September 11th, for any kind of military actions, but also to actively participate. And finally, yesterday, the German government announced that they would send 3,900 soldiers into the war, both army forces, sea-based forces, special tanks against nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. The German government is claiming that there was a specific request coming from Washington. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld last night has denied that. So this is still an open question which is under debate in Germany. It looks, though, as if the coalition government of the Greens and the Social Democrats don't get their own majority together once Parliament will debate and decide about it, first time probably tomorrow, Thursday, and because a number of members of the Green Party of Parliament will vote against it, and even among the Social Democratic majority group in the government, there is some resistance. So Schröder will only get the support by the parliament if the Christian Democrats and liberal opposition vote in favor, which they most likely will do. The only party that is against it is the Party of Democratic Socialism, which is the successor of the former East German Communist Party. There will be a number of rather big demonstrations and rallies starting tonight in Germany and also over the weekend and next week. Here in Geneva, it's expected that over the weekend, starting Saturday, there will be big demonstrations against the WTO round to be held in Doha and against the idea of having a new comprehensive round of trade negotiations.
Andre Zumach, thanks very much for that comprehensive look at both the WTO and the story that you broke in your newspaper, Die Tageszeitung, about the U.S. receiving assurances from bin Laden for the World Trade Organization to go on smoothly in Qatar. Stay with us. The group Fizz singing at a peace rally in Charlottesville. on October 28th here. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the U.S.-led war on Afghanistan continues, global trade is increasingly being invoked as a new weapon system. The U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick dubs the new agenda fighting terrorism through trade. In the wake of the terrorist attack on the United States, the U.S. and Europe have intensified efforts to launch a new round of global trade negotiations at the WTO meetings that's scheduled in Qatar. Canadian, U.S., European, and South American groups have called November 9th, the first day of the WTO meetings, as an international day of protest against the WTO. We're joined right now by Tony Clark, who is co-chair of the Common Front in the World Trade Organization and vice chair of the Council of Canadians. Tony Clark has just recently written a paper which points out that the war against terrorism is being fought primarily on the issue of physical safety, not the deeper dimensions of common security. Can you talk about how you're reframing the issue of national security, the whole question of what actually guarantees security?
Well, I think there's no doubt about it that you know, everybody was faced with a major blow as a result of what happened on 9/11, and so therefore there had to be a complete rethink of the way in which we go about these issues. And we all know that just a few short months before September 11th, there was a huge demonstration in Genoa, which I think was probably the apex of the anti-corporate globalization movement. But as in the wake of 9/11, we are all faced with having to rethink the way in which we approach these issues, simply because the number one concern that's on people's minds is security. The problem is that security is defined in terms of physical safety, as your introduction indicated. And really, security has to do with a whole lot of other things, whether or not people feel secure in their jobs, whether they feel secure in terms of their incomes, whether they feel that health and education and water are secure parts of their common life, and whether or not people have secure access to food and so forth. And so these are fundamental issues and dimensions of security, and have been for a long time fundamental to the definition of what security is in the broadest sense of the term. So what many of us have been trying to do is to say, well, look, we need to recast the way in which we come at these issues, still sticking with the same theme, still sticking with the same analysis about corporate-led globalization, but do so in a way that starts to talk about these issues again in the context of what's uppermost in people's minds.
So can you talk about how you're reframing this in terms of security and the specific areas that you think are most important?
Well, principally what we had to do in our work is that we had built a campaign, through the summer leading up into the fall, and then when September 11th came along, we had to completely reframe that campaign. And the way in which we did it was that this was a campaign leading up to the ministerial meetings of the World Trade Organization, which start at the end of this coming week. And therefore, we needed to kind of reframe our campaign in terms of the World Trade Organization and its impact. So therefore, we began to take a whole new look at the World Trade Organization and our analysis of it. And we began to see that if there is a cause or a set of causes about global insecurities, it has to do with the way in which this institution has been put together and the way it operates. So let's kind of go back at things again and take a look at that from that perspective. And we began to see that the World Trade Organization really has rules that are built into it that do not promote job creation, that do not promote income distribution, and therefore causes economic insecurity. We saw that the power that's concentrated in the WTO gives the enormous power to a body of trade experts to strike down laws, policies, and programs of democratically elected governments. That creates political insecurity. We saw, for example, that the GATS negotiations that are taking place at the WTO right now on are now getting into setting a set of rules for a whole area of social services and public services that cover healthcare and education and water and environment services. And this is going to create enormous insecurity in those areas. And the same in the agricultural negotiations on food. I mean, the whole emphasis is on enhancing the power of agribusiness corporations over that of small producers and small farmers, and so therefore creates another set of food insecurity for a lot of people in the world. So we began to redefine things along those kinds of lines and began to see those issues in those terms, and particularly looking at the impact of what the WTO does as a real engine of global insecurity.
We're talking to Tony Clark. He's co-chair of Canada's largest public interest organization. It is called the Council of Canadians. We're speaking to him in Ottawa, where next week there will be a meeting of the G20. What is the G20?
Yes, that'll be on November 17th to 19th. It's the G20 is made up of the finance ministers from a number of the leading industrialized countries and a few select countries from the south. And they will be meeting in Ottawa. This meeting is really an attempt to try to bring together the agenda that was supposed to be a part of the World Bank and IMF meetings that you will recall were to be held in Washington, D.C. at the end of September, but were canceled in the wake of what happened on 9/11. And so, therefore, that agenda, in effect, is now going to be transferred to these Ottawa meetings starting November 17th to 19th.
What about the crackdown that we're seeing in the United States and the whole discussion of dissent? How much space is there for that? Do you see people who are traditionally out in the streets and very outspoken afraid to turn out?
Definitely that same kind of atmosphere, perhaps to a slightly lesser extent, exists here in Canada at the present time, in the sense that we are going through, just like you are, the homeland security apparatus is being put together there in the United States. We are faced with a new set of legislation, what we call an omnibus bill, which is going to call for major changes in a whole variety of pieces of legislation in this country, dealing with our immigration policies, our refugee policies, the powers that the police have for search and seizure, and all of this, of course, will be put together in a way that will mean that there is a whole new set of restrictions going to be put on civil liberties. We just had, just to give you an example of this in terms of our own sensitivities, is that for the lead up to the WTO at the end of this week, the big meetings that are going to be taking place in Qatar, we have had a caravan going from the western part of the country and a caravan going from the eastern part of the country. And that caravan's been going to communities and towns across the country, meeting with people and talking about the World Trade Organization and much in the same way that I've just been talking a few minutes ago. And on that caravan, we have people from different countries in the south, from Bolivia, from Colombia, from India, from parts of the Caribbean. And the people from Colombia, for example, the person is in real danger herself in terms of her own life back home. And so we've had to be very extra careful with regards to that caravan and how that caravan proceeds from town to town and city to city. We know that the police and the security forces are watching very closely, and therefore we have to be very extra cautious and extra careful.
Tony Clark, I want to thank you very much for being with us, co-chair of the Common Front on the World Trade Organization, vice chair of the Council of Canadians, the largest public interest group in Canada. You are listening to the War and Peace Report as we come back home to the United States to have a discussion, perhaps a debate, about the war and where progressives in this country stand today. There's a front page piece in the Washington Post today that says war support falls worldwide. September 11th doesn't justify bombing, many say. And it starts off in Mexico City. says it was a traditional altar for Mexico's Day of the Dead observance, filled with flowers, candles, and sweetbread laid out for departed loved ones. Except this one also featured bagels and photos of New York, and it sat next to the U.S. Embassy as a show of solidarity with the victims of the September 11th attacks. Mexicans who showed up to inaugurate the display made clear their sympathy for the dead in the United States, but they also made clear that sympathy did not necessarily translate into support for the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Well, today we're going to talk about people mobilizing against that war and the different strategies they've taken. We're joined by Todd Gitlin, professor of culture, journalism, and sociology at New York University, author of The 60s, The Twilight of Common Dreams. Katha Pollitt is with us. She is a columnist with The Nation magazine and author of the book Subject to Debate, Sense and Dissents on Women, Politics, and Culture. We're also joined by Kristen Scher, who is a social justice activist working with the New York Anti-War Coalition. She's a political science graduate student at the New School here in New York, and Eric Tang, an organizer with the Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence. Todd Gitlin, you wrote a piece that appeared on Common Dreams, liberal activists finding themselves caught between a flag and a hard place. Explain.
There's a tendency on the part of people faced with an unprecedented situation to find precedents for it and to repeat themselves. Generals are famous for fighting the last war, and I think anti-war activists are at risk of fighting against Vietnam. This isn't Vietnam. And the arguments that are made are as, and the tone in which they're made are as important, I would say actually more important than the positions, because the dilemma is a real one. It's not a spurious dilemma. When a large number of people who are citizens of a country are killed, the government is expected to protect them. And the question is how to do it, not whether to do it. Now, there are many important questions to be raised against the war that's on, and I share in the dismay about that war. But I think it's also the obligation of people who are opposed to this war to give a real, not a rhetorical, not a casual, but a substantial answer to the question, what should the U.S. government do to protect American citizens? This is not a casual answer. You can't say, as we said in the 60s, and as it was right to say in the 60s, when asked, how can we withdraw our troops from Vietnam, put them on boats. That was a legitimate and sufficient answer. It's not a sufficient answer in this case. Bin Laden is not the invention of George Bush. He was not manufactured by the CIA. He's an actual person with an actual organization of people who are trying to put together the maximum possible murderous power against Americans. This can't be simply foisted off upon a non-existent court to be captured by non-existent police. Are we supposed to be dropping subpoenas on parachutes? I mean, that's as laughable as dropping peanut butter and bean sandwiches in Afghanistan. So I think the problem for the anti-war movement is how does it retain or get credibility? Most people are not pacifists. Hardly anybody is a pacifist. If you're a pacifist, then you have a consistent position. But if you're not a pacifist and you think that in principle the use of force can be legitimate, then what do you propose to do? I think that's a fair question to be posed to anti-war activists.
And Katha Pollitt.
Well, Todd and I were just saying that we agreed with half of each other's columns. And I agree with a lot of what Todd said. I guess I certainly don't have any, brilliant foreign policy solutions for what we should do at this point. But I do think it is relevant how we got to this place. And it is relevant what the consequences, intended and unintended, of what we're doing now, the bombing of Afghanistan, are going to be. I mean, I think this Washington Post article is not the only one that says people around the globe do not support this. The outcome could be, the long-term consequences could be very bad. I think that's important to think about. I would be so much happier is not the word, but I would feel less anxious about what our government is doing now if the UN had a role, for example. But how could the UN have a role that wouldn't look just like the United States steamrolling over it, given that we walked out of the Durban Racism Conference. When the International Court makes a decision we don't like, we just say, well, too bad. I mean, I think there is a history here that has brought us to this place, and you can't, the world didn't begin on September 11th. And I think it's very important for the peace movement or the anti-war movement to raise those questions.
Eric Tang, you are an anti-war activist. What is your response to you can't just do nothing?
Well, I want to begin by maybe addressing the issue around the anti-war movement or the core of the anti-war movement, what that is, what that looks like. I think it's clear to say from the outset that the anti-war movement today, the nascent anti-war movement, and the anti-war movement, from what I understand, of 30 years ago during the Vietnam conflict, was diverse. And today we see that same diversity. We see many different trends. And I wouldn't say that there's a central axis in this anti-war movement. So I want to begin by saying, when we talk about the current war anti-war movement being filtered through the prism of a Vietnam anti-war paradigm, I want to really question, well, what and who? Primarily, I'm thinking of the new immigrant communities, the new racial communities here in New York City, who, after 9/11, carried out some very creative and interesting anti-war activities that didn't really hit anyone's frequency, but were powerful nonetheless. I'm thinking of undocumented Mexican worker communities that came out calling for peace 2 or 3 days after they found out that hundreds of their community members had been lost at the World Trade Center. I'm talking about communities that worked in the Arab and South Asian and multinational Arab communities who courageously stepped forward to talk about peace in the days following 9/11 when they were physically at risk. I think there's a new anti-war movement among these communities that we have to pay careful attention to that really don't have much to do with this prism that we're calling the Vietnam War anti-war movement.
Todd Gitlin.
Well, I think it's extraordinary that Mexican immigrants and South Asians and others at risk carved out a space to take that position. On the other hand, to call for peace, it seems to me, won't do. Because there's a real problem. And it's a real problem for Mexican immigrant workers and South Asians and people of every origin. I don't think you have to be a Yahoo who supports the demented crusade that Bush blurted out to understand that there is in the world a real force that wants to create a super state. And it's a super state along the lines of the Taliban. And it's a super state that is potentially fueled, it's true, and worryingly true, by the bombing that's going on today. But it is nonetheless a super state that intends a rollback of the best of Western values against the reason of Islam, against the reason of Christianity, against the reason of atheism and the Enlightenment, against the reason of Judaism. It is a menace to real life. And we're not there yet. We're not, that is, Bin Laden doesn't have the apparatus, but he would surely like to get it. And this can't be blown away as a fiction of American imperialism. It has to be taken on straight. And I don't see that the call for peace does that.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. We'll be back in this discussion about war and peace. Stay with us.
What is it good for?
Absolutely.
Nah.
Listen to me.
Again. War.
War.
War, Edwin Starr, here on the War and Peace Report as we break the sound barrier. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest, Todd Gitlin, author of The 60s, The Twilight of Common Dreams, and coming out with his book, Media Unlimited, How the Torrent of Images and Sounds Overwhelms Our Lives. Katha Pollitt, Nation columnist and author of the book Subject to Debate. Eric Tang with the Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence. And we're going to go now to Kristen Schur, who is with the New York Anti-War Coalition, a student at the New School. Todd Gitlin says, peace is not the answer right now.
What the peace movement in New York is trying to address at this point is that the United States does continually fund and put into place bloody regimes that do support its geopolitical interests, and then when the United States is finished with them, they toss them aside and take revenge on its citizenry, as we're seeing happening in Afghanistan right now, which we saw happen in Iraq, where a million people have died due to the sanctions. And even if we don't want to blame it all on the U.S. or, you know, think that it's all U.S. hegemony, we need to take those things seriously as well. And I agree with Katha Pollitt when she said the world did not start on September 11th. These things have been going on for years and years. In 1948, when Israel took over Palestinian territory and the U.S. continued to fund that, $3 billion a year. These are the things that are important for us to remember, that nothing started on September 11th. When the U.S. helped overthrow Mossadegh in 1953 and put the Shah in place, who then killed an entire generation of would-be radical students, leaving really only the only recourse for any sort of radical movement to be through religion. And here we see the spoils of that over and over and again. I also think that it's important for us to remember that we have seen no credible evidence that bin Laden had anything to do with this particular attack. Perhaps he did. I'm certainly not a fan of the man. The Taliban is a terrible, bloody regime. But we've been presented with nothing. So imagine if someone in Iran said, hand me over Reagan, I'm not going to give you any evidence, just hand him over, I'll do with him what I will. No one would do it. That's a laughable suggestion. And so we don't have much by way of international justice organizations. That's something that the anti-war movement is thinking about. What do we mean by justice right now? But bombing Afghan citizens certainly is not justice. And that's the most important thing to remember right now. And at the very least, we could have waited, seen actual evidence, presented it to the world, and let the UN take over, or let Afghanistan decide what they wanted to do about it, instead of just dropping bombs that look like food packages.
Katha Pollitt.
I want to just go back to what Todd was saying about this is a war of enlightenment values versus the other kind of values, the bad fundamentalist medieval values. I guess I would quarrel with that. I think everything we've seen suggests that American foreign policy is one of the big issues here. I don't think that whoever blew up the World Trade Center did so because they want women to wear burqas. And I'm totally opposed to the Taliban and all of that. And I am a proud atheist myself. But I think that we have to take seriously the unfortunate fact that the issue of Israel and the Palestinians and the issue of the sanctions against Iraq are very important to millions of people around the world. And whether you want to say, well, that's because they're manipulated by their leaders, or that's because they're in so much despair or whatever, it has to be dealt with. And I think that it would be a really great move toward peace for the United States to really put some real pressure on the Israelis to be just to the Palestinians. And I think one of the only good things that has come out of this is that Bush was making little motions in the direction of a two-state, quote, solution, unquote.
Todd Gitlin.
Well, I'm certainly for the U.S. putting pressure on the Israelis to reach a just peace. And if I knew what to do about the U.S. support of the Shah of Iran, 50 years ago, I would gladly go to the barricades on that. But you see, we're now living in November 2001. The U.S. and the rest of the West was complicit in forcing a settlement upon the German Empire after World War One, which had dire effects. It stoked up inflation. Hitler was supported by Henry Ford and other Americans and many corporations, as we now well know. And the U.S. in that sense was deeply complicit. Nonetheless, then there was Hitler. And there he was with an army and a Gestapo and all the rest of that. And you could not replay that awful history. You just can't do it. Same thing is true now. The fact that many people in the world want the U.S. to change its foreign policy should be taken seriously. That doesn't mean that they know exactly what to do about American foreign policy, but it certainly is true that we should be doing that. And any claim, and I think the Democrats are deeply complicit here in thinking that in order to prove their patriotism, they have to collapse and terminate debate. There's no question, but that is awful. On the other hand, I disagree with Kath about one thing. I think that bin Laden did, and I can't see how it was anybody outside the realm of al-Qaeda, since they had the means, they have tested their stuff, their people are implicated, their funds are implicated. There's evidence in the Tony Blair statement. This is not the sort of thing that holds up in court, but it was good enough to impress Musharraf, who after all had been supporting the Taliban for years. The U.S. has been trying, by the way, to get the Taliban to turn them over to justice for many years. The guy blew up the American embassies in Africa, showing very little interest in the victims of American foreign policy in Kenya or Tanzania. So I think that what's plain is that we have a real situation that is partly fueled by a hatred of American foreign policy, a list, by the way, that bin Laden shifts every few months as he finds a new way of gaining support. And of course, he's a politician, he does that. But of course they blew up the World Trade Center because they want women to wear burqas. They are an offshoot of Wahhabi Islam, which is a rollback program, a totalitarian program, which rides most heavily on the backs of women. And that is what he and the Taliban would do if permitted to get away with it.
Eric Tang.
I think Todd's question is a good question. I think it's a good challenge. The left needs to be stronger about talking concretely about what should be done. There's no question about that. But I think that there are other tasks that are just as pressing. And one of the main tasks we learned prior to September 11th, about 2 weeks before when we were in Durban, South Africa, at the World Conference Against Racism, and I think for many of us who were part of that delegation coming from the United States, we did feel a sense of endangerment even then. Why? Because the issue of Palestine was really the vanguard issue at that point. And NGOs from across the world, and we're not talking about just the, you know, your radical wings, we're talking about your mainstream NGOs, were disgusted with the United States, both in terms of its failure to participate, its arrogance, and as well as its denial of some of the crimes that were happening in apartheid Palestine. They were also disgusted with the U.S. in terms of its treatment, its ongoing treatment of Iraq and the millions of children who have died. That has put us in a dangerous position internationally. We felt that before September 11th. Now, if you look at some of the discussion post September 11th, the main issues coming from the broader world community in terms of trying to, not to say that the activities of September 11th are all justified, but looking for an explanation, they do turn to these two major U.S. foreign policies, Palestine and Iraq. And we need, as a left, to take care of that and begin to answer that and begin to shape our understanding of why the rest of the world, and not just the Islamic fundamentalist world, but students in Europe, students in Africa, South Africans who we marched with, are have no faith in the United States. And we need to begin to figure out how we craft an anti-militarism, a pro-justice, a pro-global justice agenda with those allies.
Kristen Schur, how are you organizing in these last few minutes? The question has been raised, do people go out and protest in the streets?
Absolutely, we go out and protest in the streets. The day that the U.S. started bombing Afghanistan, 10,000 people mobilized and marched, we were stopped just short of Times Square, where I understand we must reach Times Square in order to get assurance of mainstream news coverage. So we didn't really get much coverage. We held a rally previous to that, asking for alternatives to a bombing campaign, asking to stop racist attacks against Muslims and Arabs in this country. We had 4,000 people, and the news showed two dozen kids waving flags on Staten Island and said, "It's all stars and stripes in New York today." There isn't a lot of honesty going on in the reporting right now. The CNN chairperson told his staff to make sure that they didn't spend too much time on the Afghan casualties, because right now it would be crass somehow to show suffering in Afghanistan. These are the things that we are organizing against.
Kathy Paula.
I just want to underscore something that that Kristen and Eric have been getting at, which is, you know, it may be that, okay, bringing up Mossadegh 50 years ago seems like you're bringing out, you know, the old history books from the closet, but Saudi Arabia is our ally right now, and Saudi Arabia is the home of the Wahhabism that that Todd is rightly so exercised about. And we've been all in favor of that. We supported the Pakistani government when it allowed all those horrible madrasas that promote this extreme, you know, misogynist and jihad-oriented form of Islam. So it's all happening now. It's not ancient history. And so I think that just as Todd is entitled to say, and I ask myself also, well, okay, so what do we do now? I think you have to say, well, what do we do now about the fact that we're still in bed with the very philosophy we claim that we are fighting against?
On that note, we have to wrap up the discussion. I want to thank everyone for being here. It's a continued discussion that we have all the time here on the War and Peace Report with these new faces and voices. Todd Gitlin, professor of culture, journalism, sociology at New York University. His coming book is Media Unlimited, How the Torrent of Images and Sounds Overwhelms Our Lives. We've also been joined by Katha Pollitt of The Nation, and her book is Subject to Debate, Sense and Dissents on Women, Politics, and Culture. Kristen Schur has been our guest from the New School, a New York anti-war activist, and Eric Tang, organizer with the Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, and Brad Simpson. Our engineer and music maestro is Anthony Sloan. You can hear us at WBIX.org and webactive.com. We are broadcasting on Manhattan Neighborhood Network Channel 34 on CUNY Television late at night, on freespeech.org and the Dish TV satellite channel 9415. We're broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Somebody please tell me what is war all about, and why must I kill against my will? I just can't figure it out. Oh,
stop the war now.
Good God, hear me say,
don't put it off
another day.
From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! In Exile.
Good morning. I'm George Gersey. I'm a fireman in Manhattan. And I would say that right now, if Rudy Giuliani tried to run as dog catcher, he would not get a vote among the members of the fire department.
New York City police arrest 12 firefighters after blocking them from Ground Zero. The city says it's concerned for their safety. The firefighters say the city cares more about excavating the gold and silver beneath the ruins than retrieving human remains. We'll talk with two firefighters. Then billionaire Michael Bloomberg spends his way into City Hall in New York's mayoral elections, the most expensive in the history of the country. end as President Bush tries to enlist Indonesia in the so-called war on terrorism, we'll talk with two of that country's leading human rights activists about Indonesian terror. Stay with us. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from Ground Zero. The first Ground Zero, Afghanistan, is the second. We broadcast from a firehouse that used to be inside the evacuation zone, but a police checkpoint still remains just outside the firehouse doors. This morning, as I came in a taxi, the army stopped the taxi cab and questioned the taxi cab driver. When he gave them his driver's license and we were finally able to leave, I asked him how he felt, and he said, "This is what it feels like to be a Muslim in America." I'm Amy Goodman. Here are some of the news headlines. Republican multi-billionaire media mogul Michael Bloomberg parlayed his bankroll and Mayor Rudy Giuliani's backing to narrowly defeat Democrat Mark Green last night to be New York's 108th mayor. In a 5-to-1 Democrat town, Bloomberg spent more than $50 million of his fortune in the most expensive mayoral race in the country's history. In New Jersey, Democrat Jim McGreevy was elected governor, ending 8 years of Republican control. In Virginia, Democrat Mark Warner, a multimillionaire cell phone mogul, defeated Republican Mark Early to be governor. And Cincinnati Mayor Charlie Lukin won re-election despite harsh criticism of his response to mass protests sparked by the police killing of an unarmed black man last spring. The U.S. has used the biggest conventional bomb in its armory, the 15,000-pound Daisy Cutter, at least twice in Afghanistan in the past few days. The bombs are pushed out of the back of C-130 aircraft on pallets and detonate about 3 feet above the ground, covering a mile-wide area with a mushroom cloud of aluminum powder, which burns at about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The explosion has been described as being like a nuclear weapon without the fallout. The Pentagon says it's using the bombs on Taliban caves. The blast would crush underground tunnels and structures, and people inside would be incinerated. The Washington Post is reporting that the initial global burst of solidarity with the U.S. after September 11th has frayed considerably. In Germany, polls show more than 65% of respondents now want the U.S. to end the attacks in Afghanistan. In Spain, 70% want the bombing to stop. Support for the U.S. war has also dropped dramatically in France and Britain. Meanwhile, President Bush yesterday delivered what The Guardian is calling his most belligerent speech since the wavering U.S. bombing campaign began, issuing two extraordinary messages to his allies as he tried to keep them in line. He first described what could happen if Osama bin Laden obtained nuclear weapons. Then he threatened his allies with action if they failed to provide more support to the U.S. He said, quote, "A coalition builder must do more than just express sympathy. A coalition builder must perform." He added, "It's going to be important for nations to know they will be held accountable for inactivity. You're either with us or you're against us in the fight against terror." The London Guardian is reporting that FBI and military intelligence officials in Washington say they were prevented for political reasons from carrying out full investigation into members of the bin Laden family in the U.S. before the attacks of September 11th. FBI documents shown on BBC last night show they had earlier sought to investigate two of Osama bin Laden's relatives in Washington, but the FBI files were closed in 1996, apparently before any conclusions could be reached on either the bin Laden brothers or the organization called the World Assembly of Muslim Youth. High-placed intelligence sources in Washington told The Guardian this week there were always constraints on investigating the Saudis. They said the restrictions became worse after the Bush administration took over. The intelligence agencies have been told to back off from investigations involving other members of the bin Laden family, the Saudi royals, and possible Saudi links to the acquisition of nuclear weapons by Pakistan. Until recently, the bin Laden family has funded to a large extent the Carlyle Group, which George Bush Sr. Is a part of, a senior member of. Meanwhile, the FBI has concluded that the intelligence behind last week's warning that terrorists might attack West Coast bridges wasn't credible.
Take this message to my brother.
The Doobie Brothers taking it to the streets here on the War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. A brief but emotionally wrenching scuffle broke out last Friday between New York City firefighters and police officers at the scene of their shared grief, the World Trade Center disaster site. A dozen firefighters were arrested and five police officers were injured in the incident, which rattled the city's top officials and laid bare the frustrations of the living who are unable to bury their dead. What began as a demonstration by several hundred firefighters to protest a reduction in the number of firefighters permitted at the site turned into a succession of awkward moments, some ugly, some poignant. One moment, punches were being thrown in a melee between firefighters and police. The next, hundreds of firefighters were chanting their appreciation for the officers they just grappled with. The two-hour protest concluded outside City Hall, where dozens of helmeted police, some on horseback, prepared for more trouble as firefighters called for the ousters of Mayor Giuliani and the fire commissioner and demanded the right to retrieve the remains of dead colleagues. The Giuliani administration says it's heeding the advice of safety experts where swinging girders and rumbling backhoes pose a danger and where many workers have developed chronic chest pains and coughing fits. Well, we turn first right now to Peter Gorman, who's president of the United of the Uniformed Fire Officers Association. He speaks to us on a cell phone on his way to City Hall. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you very much. Misinformation there. I'm not on the way to City Hall. I'm just on my way to the fire headquarters for a meeting with the department. It's not a City Hall meeting at all.
Oh, excuse me.
Okay.
Okay. So can you start off by just telling us what happened in your own words last Friday?
Well, the important part, and I have to admit I was emotional that day, and I certainly was emotional over the weekend when I found out 20 detectives were assigned to arrest me. But the real issue here, and maybe it didn't come through, we're trying to get that story out, is that we had been hearing from our families all week long last week that they wanted to come down to this site with these widows. They're grieved, upset, angry people, and that's all understandable. It was not a union-sanctioned protest. We went to the first deputy fire commissioner, myself and my fellow union leader, Kevin Gallagher, and we pleaded with them that it had to be better communications and information transmitted to these families and to these members. The fire department, a big department, but a small family. Every grieving family has family members and the firefighters that are taking care of them. When our staff chiefs and command chiefs knew this was the wrong decision for the fire department, that information got to the families. We urged the first deputy fire commissioner to have the department, the commissioner, somebody address these families to explain this process. That didn't happen Tuesday. It didn't happen Wednesday. By Thursday morning, we realized things were frantic. We were in touch with our constituents. Kevin Gallagher had asked for an emergency meeting. He called Joe Loder, the first deputy mayor, and begged for a meeting. We finally got that meeting at 3 o'clock in the afternoon with Deputy Mayor Tony Coles. Kevin Gallagher and I went in there with the vice president of the PBA, and we begged them to keep the policy in place for several days until such time that the top police ESU commanders and my fire department commanders and my special operations people met with the Department of Design and Construction, who was overseeing this operation, and the mayor's office to come up with a workable plan. And once that plan was agreed to, then the information could be, you know, transmitted down to the rank and file and to those families, either directly or indirectly. I had suggested directly. I told them what was going to happen. I said the emotions were going to run high. I said, help us defuse this situation. Kevin Gallagher said the same thing. We got no phone call back. Kevin Gallagher from the Uniformed Firefighters Association and his board decided he had to join his members if they were going down there. Labor could not turn their back on their own. And I similarly made the same decision. I was not roped into it. My board made the same decision to stay with our families. And that's the real story that happened here. We were ignored by City Hall after two union leaders pleaded with the mayor's office on Thursday and pleaded with the first deputy fire commissioner at the Office of Labor Relations the Tuesday before. No one responded to us. The fire commissioner had no idea of the tensions and the emotions that were out there. That is most unfortunate. And my sources in City Hall tell me that once the mayor found out that firefighters were demonstrating, whether it was peacefully or not, he would look bad. That confrontation, and it was unfortunate, and my brother's a career police officer. He's a captain in the NYPD, as most fire people, families have police officers in their same families. Indeed, brothers died side by side from police and fire. But he was determined he was not going to look bad. We would look bad. Well, good for you, Mr. Mayor. You made us look a little bad, but our message is clear. And we will not be stopped. And then he went on after these arrests, which were unfortunate, and the police brass, they were doing their job. That's what police officers do, and that's what firefighters did. But this confrontation was bound to happen. They knew the emotionally charged nature of this situation, and that pretty much lays out exactly where we are today.
So firefighters have now been told to back off Ground Zero.
Well, see, when the plan, if you go back to the media accounts, when they went down to 25 firefighters, the mayor and the fire commissioner said, oh, this will be exactly the same. We will have the same ability to search for voids when there are remains found. So those voids can be shored up, made safe, and searched and bodies removed. They said that. But after this confrontation, the mayor is saying now, oh, you know, we really can't do things the same they were. Bodies are being vaporized. Now, that's unfortunate, but it is a true statement. But they're still, as we speak, they are still finding remains of victims intact, particularly in those stairwells where most people were. The structure of a stairwell itself creates voids, and that's where the few people that escaped that day came out from stairwell voids. That's where they're finding people along with other voids, and the mayor is not being honest with people. And the grim reality is that Kevin Gallagher had two board members go out to the landfill. They are for the first time finding torsos, and I'm not going to be more graphic than that, at the landfill. That wasn't happening when there was due diligence to recovering remains. Victims.
And just as explain to our listeners around the country, when you say when they go out to the landfill, you're talking about the Staten Island landfill where the debris is taken from the World Trade Center site. And so when you say torsos are found at the garbage landfill, that means that they aren't being uncovered at the Ground Zero where they go through the rituals and the ceremony when they're found.
Right.
Peter Gorman is with us right now on the telephone as he walks to a meeting to deal with what took place last Friday. He is the president of the Uniform Fire Officers Association. When you saw the gold and the silver excavated from below the World Trade Center site, what were your thoughts?
Well, listen, we knew that gold was going to be retrieved. However, I was never happy with the fact that we knew that was an economic priority to take that gold out. And Bill Miro from the Uniform Firefighters Association said it very eloquently the other day. When the mayor had met with our families in mid-September, it was a difficult meeting that I actually thought was a bad idea, but it went well. He told those families, that were grieving families, that we will not stop looking for your loved ones until the last brick is removed. Well, I guess our families didn't realize he was talking about the last brick of gold, and that is the grim reality here. These, you know, you can't lie to these families. You can't mislead them. Even though I disagree with 25, I would give more credit to the administration and the department if they were honest with people. Be honest with people. They're trying to mislead people, and I think that's becoming more evident by the day. He is trying to mislead people. You can't do that. This is a family. They know what's going on.
Peter Gorman, how many firefighters died?
343 firefighters died, two EMTs and paramedics of the FDNY and a member of the New York Fire Patrol. 346 members of the FDNY died that day.
And were you arrested on Friday?
I was not arrested on Friday. I was called Saturday evening at my home to turn myself into the first precinct Sunday morning. Or else they would come to my home and arrest me. And I wasn't looking to have people come to my home, so I turned myself in on Sunday.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Peter Gorman, president of the Uniformed Firefighters Fire Officers Association, on a cell phone as he heads to a meeting at fire headquarters. We're also joined in the studio by a firefighter who has repeatedly been at Ground Zero. He is George Gersey. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning, Amy.
Were you there on Friday?
I was not. I was at a memorial service in Queens on Friday.
Where were you on September 11th?
Actually, I was safe in an airport in Tampa, Florida. I had just landed.
You came back to New York, and how much time did you spend at the disaster site?
Well, I returned to New York as quickly as I could, and we all took turns going down there. Either on a volunteer basis or assigned as your company was assigned, and it varied from individual to individual. I was there maybe two or three periods during that first week right after the 11th.
And what was it like there then? What were you doing?
Well, as a member of a tower ladder company, the main duty was to provide water through the the tower ladder, through the water gun that we have stationed up on in the tower ladder to keep the rubble cool while the workers were actually trying to extract pieces, smaller pieces, from the rubble to be removed. At times, we also had to remove debris, even if it was by bucket, bucket by bucket, from hand to hand, through a line of people. There were various things. There was also a lot of standing around while the iron workers actually did most of the work. The work involved cutting pieces of metal, removing the same, and working actually in the pile of rubble. So there was various tasks, but I would say the vast majority of the time that I was down there, I was actually throwing water on the rubble, trying to keep it cool, actually up in the air over the a portion of the site, in a bucket, aiming water into it.
What do you think of what happened with the police and firefighters?
Well, I find it on one level rather surprising that the average firefighter is discovering just recently how ruthless our Mayor Rudy Giuliani can be. I think the man has shown himself over the years, over his last two terms, his 8 years in office, to be this way with all sorts of groups and people which he considered to be a threat to good order or to law and order or to whatever it was that he fancied. He had a some sort of job to do. I believe he lied to a lot of the fire department personnel and to their families, and to, of course, especially the families of the missing. And when there was a conflict, he did what I thought was I actually didn't think it was much of a surprise. He did what he usually does. He did it his way. He did it without consulting the fire department, and he really hurt a lot of people within the fire department and families.
How many remains have been found of firefighters? How many firefighters have been identified?
I haven't the exact figure, Amy. It's, I would think, not all that many out of the 343. I would say no more than 40 or 50, perhaps.
Given all of this, are you for the bombing of Afghanistan?
I find it hard, quite difficult, to think that we're going to stop terrorism by committing more acts of terrorism. I think the bombing is not justified. I think that the resulting destruction in a country that's already been heavily bombed and destroyed for the most part is not going to do any good but to create more hatred and more acts of terrorism and put, as well as firefighters, but everyone here in the United States in very much in harm's way.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, George Gersee. At this point in your fire unit, how many men have been lost?
We lost 11 men. We lost the entire complement, the entire crew of both companies, that's Engine 40 and Ladder 35, that was working that day. And my battalion, which is five companies, which includes 54 Engine and Ladder 4 in 8th Avenue and 48th Street, and Engine 23 in 58th Street, as well as my house. Everyone, every person, every firefighter, including the chief and his driver that was working that day, was lost.
How does it feel coming here to the firehouse of Engine Company 31 in Chinatown to do this interview?
Well, it's somewhat nostalgic. I used to come here as a boy with my papa. He was a firefighter. He used to come here and stop in here on his way to the municipal building to take care of a little business. And I haven't been in here since I was a small lad, so it's kind of nice.
Last question. My colleague Juan Gonzalez did a major expose last week about the toxic ground that is Ground Zero right now, and the fact that workers are suffering terribly who were there day after day. Everything from benzene in the air to asbestos to fiberglass to untold number of toxins. The federal government's putting tremendous pressure on not getting this information out. But what about the firefighters who toil day and night looking for their loved ones and also cleaning up the debris in terms of their ability to breathe and their health?
Hmm. Well, that's always a problem within the fire department. The personnel actually are usually the last ones who are concerned with such things, unfortunately. They don't seem to think it's important at this time. I'm sure they'll consider it important further on down the line in the future, but right now I haven't heard anybody complain about that. What they have complained about is the double talk that's been given out over the last few weeks from the city. At one point, very adamantly saying through different tests that were conducted by I don't know who, that there wasn't really any threat to anybody there at the site at Ground Zero. And now, of course, we all know better.
Well, George Gersee, thank you for being with us. When we come back, we're going to go overseas to Indonesia, and then we'll come back home and talk about the race that just took place in New York. There were elections around the country. Here in New York, the 108th mayor will be Michael Bloomberg. He is a multi-billionaire media mogul, and he spent more money on this race, $50 million of his own money, than any mayoral candidate has ever spent in the history of the United States. Stay with us.
Blood makes noise. It's ringing in my ear, and I can't really hear you in the thick of it.
Suzanne Vega, Blood Makes Noise, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Free Speech Radio. President Bush spoke yesterday to 20 world leaders gathered in Poland for an anti-terrorism conference invoking Hitler and Stalin to declare that the terrorists behind the September 11th attacks are, quote, a threat to civilization itself. Bush said the U.S. will not rest until all the world's nations stop harboring and supporting such terrorists within their borders and called on peace-loving nations to join in the fight. In the last few weeks, Democracy Now! Has looked at some of the, quote, peace-loving nations the Bush administration has tried to enlist in the so-called war on terror. Among them, Russia, which has killed tens of thousands of people in Chechnya, China, currently killing and torturing Muslims in its northwest provinces, Uzbekistan, which has 7,000 political prisoners, and Turkey, which has killed thousands of Kurds, destroyed hundreds of villages in southern Turkey, and in the last few days has raided the homes of the hunger fasters protesting prison conditions in Turkey. 4 to 5 of them have died. And then there's Indonesia, home to one of the world's most brutal militaries, which has killed thousands of people in recent years in West Papua and Aceh. The U.S. Ambassador, Ralph Boyce, Monday urged Indonesia to remain part of the so-called coalition against terrorism in spite of rising protests against the U.S.-led attacks on Afghanistan. The Bush administration recently called for a lifting of restrictions on weapon sales to Indonesia to help it fight terrorism, which human rights activists see as a green light for the military there to commit further atrocities. We're joined right now by John Rumbiak, a leading human rights activist from West Papua, and Muhammad Nazar, founder of the Student Referendum Information Center in Aceh, recently released from prison. In fact, the last time we spoke, we talked to you on a cell phone in your cell in prison. I want to welcome you to Democracy Now!, both of you. Let's begin with Muhammad Nazar, Aceh right now in Indonesia. As we talk about terror, what is the Indonesian military doing, and why were you in jail?
I think the most important to talk with Indonesian government now, the Jakarta is still made and organized a number of military operations in Aceh. And there are in Aceh also many activists, political activists, human rights activists, and humanitarian workers demand for the withdrawing of the military in Aceh. Now this November 8th in Aceh, the people organized themselves to protest the government. They demand that the government can withdraw the military operation from Aceh and to take ceasefire with Aceh Free Movement, organized struggle for Aceh independence. And our position is to communicate the all aspiration of political of Acehnese, because now there are political clash between independence and integration supporters, such as in East Timor before. And in the matter, I think now Acehnese demand to Indonesian government to appreciate the human rights and peace solution to solve Acehnese problem comprehensively. And Amsterdam has been detained by the government because I accused by Jakarta include to oppose the policy of Jakarta. We have organized many demonstrations and civilian movement peacefully in Aceh. And every year we make the program for the civilian to appreciate the democratic situation and to pressure both sides, either Jakarta government or Free Aceh Movement, to continue the peaceful and democratic negotiation on the table.
John Rumbiak, you're in another place in Indonesia. You're from West Papua, which is out on the eastern tip of the Indonesian archipelago of thousands of islands. Where were you on September 11th?
I was down in Brisbane in Australia. I was doing my speaking tour in regarding to the human rights problems in West Papua. And I was scheduled to meet with Foreign Affairs, foreign minister, Alexander Downer, in regards to these issues. But then when things happened on the 11th of September, all my schedule totally changed, including meeting with the medias, all the attentions put on the United States.
And what was your reaction to what took place here?
I was just, when I saw the 11th of September tragedy, it's like, I said, this is going to be very difficult in raising the human rights concerns in West Papua. As for me, I began to feel that the Indonesian security forces will then use this tragedy of New York and Washington to become a justification for them to raise more military operation. And I'm right. I'm right that today, massive military operation conducted throughout West Papua. The pro-independence activists in West Papua have been accused as terrorists as a result of the 11th of September tragedy.
You mean using the word terrorists the way it's being used through by the U.S. administration now?
Yeah, that's right. The reason is that for many, many years, this particular area in the eyes of the security forces in Indonesia is seen as what they call as killing ground, which is a place where they can exercise their military theories. They gain their position and also they economically benefit. And this incident in on the 11th of September even intensified this situation.
What was your reaction to the president of Indonesia coming to Washington, meeting with Bush, and Bush announcing that there would be a lifting of restrictions on arms sales to Indonesia, something that activists had fought for many years because of Indonesia's occupation of East Timor, not to mention how it treats its own people in Indonesia?
Well, Megawati Soekarnoputri visit to the United States, I think that was the first leader of the world that meeting with W. Bush just right after the 11th of September. That has become a great concern to the human rights activists throughout the whole Indonesia because, as you know, the Indonesia is military ruled and has cost a lot of lives. Millions of people have died because of the militarism in Indonesia. And her visit and resuming the military relationship is a very dangerous kind of policy that the American government now taking on Indonesia. Megawati Soekarnoputri, even though she's the president, but she cannot control the security forces in Indonesia at all.
Let's talk about the corporations, the U.S. corporations that have interests in both places that you come from. In Aceh, we're talking about ExxonMobil. In West Papua, there's Freeport-McMoRan, which is the Louisiana-based copper and gold mining operation, has one of the largest gold and copper mining operations in the world in West Papua, which works with the security forces there. Mohamed Nazar, today is the second anniversary of the massive demonstrations you helped to organize in Aceh, which brought out more than a million people. In terms of the issue of terror, Megawati Soekarnoputri, the president, has said that the U.S. should stop bombing Afghanistan, even as she says Indonesia will fight terrorism. How is that affecting the people of Aceh right now?
I see that when Megawati visited U.S. Last month, she tried to include Aceh's struggle as the part of terrorism. This is also the problem now for Aceh's. But the fact that in Aceh there are no anti-American movement different from Jakarta. So I believe what wants by Aceh's people is to decide their future peacefully, And we hope actually to U.S. government, particularly on ExxonMobil policy, to help Achenes, because many Achenes know that Exxon also include in facilitating some human rights violations when the military operation areas 1989 to 1998. And now more than 5,000 troops, non-organic troops, from outside of Aceh sent to the to around the company, and then they interfere in the village and make military operation in massive form. And I think this is the fact going on in Aceh nowadays.
There was an article that was written by Businessweek a couple years ago that was entitled "What Mobil Knew." It's before Mobil became ExxonMobil, the largest oil company in the world. And it had a picture of a man holding a skull, and it was documenting allegations that Mobil gave excavating equipment to the Indonesian military to dig mass graves with. Do you have knowledge of that, mass graves to put, well, among others, the workers at Mobil in?
I think now some local NGOs in Aceh tried to made more investigation about the mass graves, particularly about the involving of ExxonMobil in facilitating human rights violation and helping the military facilities some years ago. And I believe that there are very possible if ExxonMobil have included in the facilitating the human rights violation in Aceh. And I think Aceh has a good culture in business matter, but of course we hope multinational corporations such as Exxon to understand about the needs of Aceh's people to appreciate the human rights and peace situation.
You're on a speaking tour now in the United States organized by the Indonesia Human Rights Network. Are you concerned about what will happen when you go back to Aceh, having spoken out in the United States?
Yeah, I think what happened to me and to the others, all activists in Aceh, this is a consequence of the our struggle, our peaceful struggle. And I believe that the future is in the hand of Achenese people, and I believe that the state terrorism in Aceh has to be stopped, not only by Jakarta government but also by international community. What happened nowadays to me and to humanitarian and human rights activists in Aceh, I think the waging terrorism by Jakarta government.
And finally, in West Papua, with Freeport-McMoRan, how closely does it work with the Indonesian military? Its human rights abuses well documented over the years.
Well, as already like repeatedly, you know, brought up to the international community, that this company, as it is considered as a national vital object by the Indonesian government. And in the contract itself, there is a clear passage that mentioning the importance of the security forces to protect the company. And as a result of the gross human rights violation taking place. However, even though this is already proved by the verification of the national Indonesian Human Rights Commission, Komnas HAM, in 1995. But the company itself keeps denying any kind of independent inquiry and never brought to justice until today. That shows how these security forces engaging very much within the company and block the possibility of any kind of justice to be taken or to be realized in Indonesia. The culture of impunity is a great problem the Indonesian human rights activists facing today, specifically on these multinational corporations, the U.S. ones.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, both of you. Our guests are Mohammed Nasr, who has just recently come out of jail in Aceh, Indonesia, where more than 1,000 people have been killed by the Indonesian military since the beginning of the year, and John Rumbiak, a leading human rights activist from West Papua, the other end of the Indonesian archipelago, and supervisor of the West Papuan human rights organization, IRSTAD, the Institute for Human Rights Studies and Advocacy. Brought here by the Indonesian Human Rights Network, and their website, if you want more information, is www.indonesianetwork.org. That's indonesianetwork.org, as you both head off to the United Nations just up the road from here near Ground Zero. When we come back, we're going to look at politics here. Stay with us.
I see the clock up on the wall, but it don't matter me at all. It's a river changing times, baby. I see the clock up on the wall, but it don't matter me at all. It's a river changing time. And I had some big ideas. So much in my life still not completed. Oh. And fear, watching you change into something new, wondering if I'm gonna find the answer in loving you all of my life. It comes back to baby.
You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Elections around the country. Here in New York, the Republican multi-billionaire media mogul Michael Bloomberg parlayed his bankroll and Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's backing to narrowly defeat the Democratic candidate Mark Green, who is the longtime city public advocate last night. Michael Bloomberg will become New York's 108th mayor. In New Jersey, Democrat Jim McGreevy was elected governor, ending 8 years of Republican control. In Virginia, it was Mark Warner, the multimillionaire cell phone mogul. In Cincinnati, the mayor, Charlie Lucan, won re-election despite harsh criticism of his response to mass protests sparked by the police killing of an unarmed black man last spring. But there were also referenda that were voted on around the country. We're going to turn now to Maine. Advocates of government-run health care in Maine claimed a narrow victory in Portland yesterday, overcoming an expensive campaign against their advisory referendum. The vote's non-binding, meaning that the Portland City Council is not required to approve any of the referendum's proposals, such as approving a city resolution supporting universal health care. Still, those who initiated a signature drive to put the question on the ballot are treating the results as a major step forward for a grassroots movement to install a single-payer system in Maine. They contend it's the most cost-effective way to meet a moral obligation to provide health insurance to all residents. We go right now to John Deven Bodercrawl. He is the co-chair of the group that push through this initiative. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. So explain what happened with an insurance industry against you, which outspent you something like, what, 25 to 1?
I think it's going to be far more than that. We estimate they will have spent more than $1.2 million to about our $30,000. We won with what good organizers knows works, grassroots organizing and a broad-based coalition to defeat the corporate money that poured into this campaign.
And explain exactly what you won.
Well, the Southern Maine Labor Party initiated this spring a referendum question, as your prelude talked about, to ask the city council to pass a resolution in support of universal health care. Maine People's Alliance, which actually I'm the co-director of, has been working on this since 1989. The Labor Party wanted to play a supportive role by having this initiative question in Maine's most populated city, Portland, with about 62,000 people. What we won is this election turned out to really be a referendum on the statewide effort. This June, we led an effort to pass legislation that was signed into law that creates a health security board, which is putting together a nuts and bolt single-payer universal health care system, which will be voted on by the Maine legislature next March. Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, which has about 80% of the insurance market now in Maine, saw this Portland non-binding referendum question as an opportunity to derail the statewide effort by saying, hey, they didn't vote for it in Portland. Why is the Maine legislature going to go for it? But we were able, through, again, a tremendous grassroots organizing in one of the biggest victories in Maine political history, to win.
Talk about Citizens for Affordable Health Care.
Unfortunately, Amy, the writer of that story got that wrong. It's actually Citizens for Sensible Healthcare Choices. But it was a classic phony AstroTurf group put together by Anthem and their consulting firm, Pierce Atwood Consulting, to try to give the appearance that, you know, there were flesh and blood human beings that were really against this. I mean, in the end, they were able to get a few people to oppose this. Mark Sensi, who's the head of the Libertarian Party in Maine, and at the last minute they got some Portland businesses. But this was really a classic corporate money. The PAC reports that had to be filed on October 31st, and they're just preliminary. We'll get the final ones on December 18th. At that point, Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield had put in more than $380,000. We and the Labor Party had raised about $13,000. So this is really about corporate power versus citizen sovereignty.
We're talking to John Deven Bokercrawl, who is co-chair of, you certainly buck the trend, I have to say, all over the country. Here in New York, we're looking at money winning big time with a mayoral candidate who spent more money than anyone has spent in the history of a mayoral race in this country, something like $50 million.
I heard 60.
Could well be that. And he used that to his advantage, saying that he was beholden to no one since he could spend his own money. Yet you have taken on some of the most powerful interests in this country, certainly the insurance industry. In terms of how this played, were you able to get that message out?
I think what Anthem spent a lot of money on TV, and it was disconcerting, Amy and the listeners. They rolled out TV ads starting the first week of October, and they just saturated the airwaves with the same sort of messages that we saw in 1993-94 when the insurance industry and others derailed the effort for national health care. The predictable messages: government bureaucracy, your taxes are going to go up, take away health care choices. But I think, you know, knowing our limited resources, we focused on, we've got to reach the voters who will actually vote on November 6th. So we focused on voter identification, voter persuasion, and a classic get-out-the-vote effort. And I salute my co-director, Tammy Grayton, and our organizers, Amy Thompson and Jesse Graham and Mary Evans. They just did a superb job, along with all the different organizations and volunteers. Our office was really humming yesterday, and we know when we work together we can win. But we would rather not be in such a disproportionate fight, and that's why really we focused our campaign for statewide universal single-payer health care at the legislative level, where we have effective campaign finance reform, thanks to the Maine Clean Election Act we helped to pass in 1996, where people can run for the state legislature 100% financed by the public and are not beholden to the Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, Aetna, or any other corporate interests that would like to see their bottom line go over what's best for the people.
Over the last few days, we've been having some conversations with people redefining what national security is. People talking about security at home that doesn't involve more police or more surveillance, but health for the population in all sorts of ways. Can you talk about how this universal healthcare initiative that you've passed through the Portland City Council, or at least one that would deal with the Portland City Council, how this fits into the whole issue of national security?
Well, I'm going to borrow some from the ideas of Jesse Jackson Jr. I don't know if you've had occasion on your show recently. I mean, I don't get to listen to it every day, but his most recent book, where he is talking about the fact that our Constitution tends to define a lot of rights about what the government shall not do to the people. But we, part of our message about single-payer universal health care is that we should view health care as a right, as security. And actually, in one of our primary literature pieces, we have three words in bold: freedom to choose providers, security from skyrocketing premiums and deductibles, and access to affordable prescription drugs. I would say yes, when we think about a moral society and what we want to achieve in that society and the richest nation in the world, there's certain fundamental things to life, and we would say those things include shelter, food, clothing, and health care. And we should, as a society, be looking to secure those for all our citizens, not just for the elite that can pay for them.
You've talked about who helped you secure this in Portland, Maine. In terms of how this fits into the overall healthcare movement in this country, can you talk about the places where you've seen some moves toward universal healthcare, and what other states are going to be the sites of initiatives like yours?
Amy, our victory this June was so exciting because we know that we've had a hard time on the question of healthcare, trying to build the kind of momentum that we had back in 93, 94. And many groups, and we've been supportive of these efforts, trying to pick up the victories where we can, like providing access to children through the federal health program that was passed in 1997. And by, in many states, doing things with prescription drugs where, you know, people are really outraged at the money that's being made by pharmaceutical companies while people die or suffer because they can't get access to prescription drugs. What our victory in June did is it reignited the fervor across the country. We literally got hundreds of emails from more than half the states in the nation, people who've been working on universal health care, but frankly have had tough sledding. So one thing, I think we've reinvigorated that movement across the country. I'm going to be speaking to the Universal Healthcare Action Network annual meeting in Baltimore on November 17th. I've been invited to speak to New Mexico activists in April. The chair of our healthcare coordinating committee, Jay Houghton, spoke in Manhattan on October 16th to Physicians for a National Health Plan. So I think what we're doing is we're putting back right front and center the fact that healthcare should be a right, and that not a government-run system, which you were reading from the story from the Portland Press Herald, but a government-finance system. We can have nonprofit, we can even have for-profit providers. But what we need to have is one payer. That is the only way that we're going to guarantee coverage, guarantee choice of provider, and get cost control.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, John Devin Bochakarl, who is co-chair of the Universal Healthcare Initiative that passed in Portland, Oregon. And that does it for today's program. In Portland, Maine. That does it for today's program. Tomorrow, we're going to take a look at the major mayoral race here in New York, with Michael Bloomberg edging out Mark Green in the race for mayor. Mark Green, when he conceded early this morning in an extremely close race, said, "When a campaign advisor last month told me that no candidate in America had ever won an election being outspent by $45 million, I thought we'd beat the odds." Well, they didn't. And we'll talk about the significance of Michael Bloomberg becoming the next mayor of New York, the Republican who's taken a 5-1 Democrat town. If you'd like to order video cassettes of the speeches of Howard Zinn or Noam Chomsky or the founder of peace studies, Johann Galtung, the Muslim liberation theologian, Faridi Saq, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. You can also go to our website that has been created by our webmaster, Jackie Suen. It's democracynow.org to get all the contacts on the people that we've spoken to during this program and links to the issues that we're dealing with. We want to thank the Democracy Now! in Exile producers, Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, Anthony Sloan, our music maestro and engineer, the video team that has been working doggedly, Rachel Jones and Orlando Richards, Lizzie Ratner, Karen Renucci, Rick Youngers, Vivian DeMuth, Emily Kunstler, Angela Aldrich, Chase Pearson. Also, thanks to the Downtown Community Television Center, where we operate from, the firehouse just blocks from Ground Zero, John Alpert and Keiko Suno, as well as Anthony Riddle at Manhattan Neighborhood Network, where we're broadcasting on channels 34 Monday through Wednesday and 56 Thursday and Friday. We're on public access stations, television stations around the country, and you can ask yours to run the War and Peace Report as well. We are also on Free Speech Channel 9415 of the Dish Network. That's Free Speech TV. You can find out more about that at freespeech.org. And you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Special thanks to KPFA and KFCF, Amy Pomerlow and Aaron Glantz, and thanks to all our Pacifica affiliates around the country. We are Pacifica. Broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Even close my eyes. About that place way across the sea, I just lay awake and dream, people, about that place way across the sea. Oh yeah, where I'm well, I dreamed I saw the city, baby, with its castles as old as time. I held hands with my baby, yes, I could hardly keep from crying. Something pretty bad has got a hold on me. Got a hold. About that place way across the sea. Well, it means so much to me.